Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Welcome to Many Happy Returns, where we aim to make you a better investor. I'm Roman.
And I'm Michael.
Antitrust is back in fashion, and US regulators have swung for the fences, accusing Apple of running an illegal smartphone monopoly. It's just the latest legal case facing the big tech firms that dominate global markets.
I want to know if increasing antitrust action could put an end to stellar stock returns. And in today's dumb question of the week, what was the Gilded Age? All right, let's get into it. So for a couple of decades, we haven't really seen regulators going after monopolies. But it seems like every day now, there's a new antitrust action announced. So we were going to talk about this big case against Apple announced by the Department of Justice in the US last week. But just as we've started to record, I see the EU's decided to go after Apple, Google, and Meta. I guess they didn't want to feel left out.
It's open season. But I think this is something we're going to see more of. And I think part of the reason is the success. And I think that's something we're going to talk about more in a moment. But the fact that these are trillion-dollar companies means that you have got this big game, and that big game is in the regulators' sights.
Yeah, if anything, it was weird that we didn't have so many antitrust cases before. It shouldn't be unusual that the government prosecutes apparent monopolies.
I think up till this point, they weren't really seen as being something sinister, as something that was stifling competition, at least by regulators, or at least they thought they couldn't get away with some kind of antitrust case.
I guess the first point to make is that it isn't illegal to be a monopoly, at least under US law. So their antitrust guidelines allow a company to just grow really big organically by being, you know, a better business, making better products. That's fine. They can come to dominate a market. What they aren't allowed to do is start buying other companies and merging with other companies to create a monopoly. And if they are a massive player, they're not allowed to abuse their monopoly to crush the competition or harm consumers or raise prices artificially high.
And that was one of the criteria that was used for a while. And really, it looked at whether it would affect the pricing of goods for consumers. But that was a pretty weak way of looking at it, because that allowed for all sorts of dodgy behavior behind the scenes, because a monopoly can cause all sorts of problems beyond price increases.
And it's also the case that many of the services we use these days are basically free to the consumer. So how do you measure monopolies in that kind of market? I think where some people get confused with monopolies is they think it has to have 100% of the market. Like, the word confuses them. But that isn't the case. It doesn't have to literally own the entire market.
And another system that you can have is an oligopoly, where there are a small number of firms that control a given market.
With pricing power.
Yeah, and that's the key thing. So, for example, if we look at house builders in the UK, a lot of people have described that as an oligopoly, because there are a very small number of companies that dominate that market, and that means that they have huge pricing power, and it's in their collective interest to lobby government in exactly the same way to keep prices high.
But if you're a firm, it's quite nice to be a monopoly, isn't it? Because you can have fat margins, you don't have to innovate so much, you can squash competitors before they get too big, either by buying them out or using predatory pricing. That's illegal, but they sometimes do it to undercut prices and drive them out of business. Like, if PensionCraft was the only place you could go for financial guidance in the UK, you could be charging anything, Robin, not the reasonable prices that you do today.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Mike.
But let's go back to Apple here. What do you reckon? The DOJ in America says they're a monopoly when it comes to the smartphone market. Do you believe it?
I think they are. I think they are at the moment. And now that they've got huge market share, and also the ability to pretty much dictate prices. But they have obviously got to that point by providing a very good product. But the question is now, are they abusing that dominance? And I think in many ways they are. They're polluting standards, something as simple as connectors for power. This is a big issue for the EU and for me as well, because I hate the fact that people go beyond USB-C. You don't really need all that many connectors. And they seem to change it every year. What's that all about, Michael?
When I read through the Department of Justice case, I just thought someone has taken Romin's hate of all things Apple and like listed it out point by point. The USB-C wasn't in there. That was an EU thing. But to go back to the question of are they a monopoly, Merrick Garland, who's the US Attorney General, did a press conference where he said that Apple has a 70% share by revenue of the high-end smartphone market in the US and a 65% share of all smartphone sales in the US. So that would be a monopoly if he's right. I saw that Apple, in a sort of off-the-record briefing, said that they're defining the market wrong and they should really be looking at global smartphone sales. Well, I thought, well, these are US regulators. They don't care so much about what goes on beyond US borders.
But you look at the list of things which they're saying is a problem with Apple's business practices, and I'd agree with every point.
Should we go through them? I think there was five key claims here that the Department of Justice is saying demonstrates Apple abusing their market power. So number one was kind of a strange one, not something you think about every day, and that was that Apple blocks innovative super apps, as the DOJ described it. So they point to something like WeChat in China, which is an app where you can basically do everything. If you're a Chinese consumer, you never really have to leave WeChat. You can do payments in there, you can do shopping, messaging, everything. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for a consumer, I don't know. But Apple really frowns upon that kind of thing and keeps it out of the App Store, because it's seen as a way to build a like operating system within an operating system. So iOS is no longer the one that's sort of managing the consumer's day-to-day interactions.
And another kind of cynical way to see it is they're not standing between the client and the services and making as much money as they could if they did.
And obviously Apple loves its 15 to 30% commission on all app sales and in-app purchases.
But that's how they keep it secure, Michael.
Well, that is Apple's point, is like everything goes through us, therefore users are in a kind of safe walled garden. People can't hear an eyebrow raise, Robin.
The second point is about streaming apps, because here Apple really pushes their own product and really locks you into their own cloud ecosystem.
Well, Apple doesn't really even offer cloud streaming, because its strength is hardware and it wants the processing to stay on the device. So you could, yeah, easily make the case, as the Department of Justice has, that it's acting anti-competitively by blocking game streaming services. Or even if they're now not exactly blocking them, they're making it so difficult for gaming platforms to operate on iOS.
Which is really naughty, I think, because I've started streaming all of my games. You know, I don't have a PlayStation, I don't have an Xbox. I play everything through GeForce Now streaming.
Snappy name. Apple would never stand for that, would they? They love a bit of branding.
I stream. I play. What would it be called? I waste my life.
Well, they have a gaming subscription service, which is called Apple Arcade. I mean, this one seems like a bit more of an obvious case of anti-competitive practice to me. I'm not a lawyer. I know lawyers, and they all say to me, Michael, you're not a lawyer, when I try to talk to them about legal things. But this is a clear example of where Apple has, on the face of it, suppressed competition on its platform. The third element of the DOJ's complaint is around messaging apps. And this is the one American consumers say they've seen a lot of. I mean, in Europe, we don't see it so much. This is the green bubbles. We just use WhatsApp or whatever, so it doesn't matter. But in the US, people use iMessage a lot. And when you're receiving messages from a non-Apple phone, an Android phone, it gives them a green bubble, not a blue bubble. And the functionality is limited because it's going through SMS.
Wasn't there some kind of Tim Cook quote about this, where someone said, I get messages from my mother and they're all kind of pixelated, and he said,
buy her an iPhone.
I bet he regrets saying that now.
Yeah, it literally is in the case. Tim Cook says, buy her an iPhone. I mean, I've seen the clip of that and everyone laughs in the room. It was a good line, but yeah, it's come back to bite him. I think the point here is not necessarily around the quality being worse. It's that Apple doesn't have iMessage on Android, so they can't lock into the same messaging platform. And even more crucially, Apple restricts SMS messages just to its messaging app. It won't let third-party messaging apps use SMS and sort of build on the back of it.
So a closed ecosystem, everything I hate.
I mean, it's Apple's business model though, isn't it? That's the thing throughout this whole case. If you look at Apple's response to it, they basically say, our whole thing is that we tie together hardware, software, and services and integrate them really tightly. If this case stands, it's basically saying, we can't be Apple anymore.
Well, that wouldn't be such a bad thing.
Really? I think a lot of people love their iPhones.
Yeah, but they'd still love it. I mean, it's the same shiny object, which is overpriced. You can still have that. It's just going to be more operable with other people's lives. So maybe I should come clean and say why I'm kind of so opposed to this kind of approach to producing products within a closed ecosystem. I kind of cut my teeth on software development when I first read a book by Richard Stallman. He's the guy who produced GNU Emacs, which is the text editor for real nerds like myself. And he also created an entire operating system, which was like Linux, but even more open source. It's the free software movement, free as in freedom. But he had a brilliant quote, and he said, "The paradigm of competition is a race. By rewarding the winner, we encourage everyone to run faster. When capitalism really works this way, it does a good job. But its defenders are wrong in assuming it always works this way. If the runners forget why the reward's offered and become intent on winning, no matter how, they may find other strategies, such as attacking other runners. If the runners get into a fist fight, they will all finish late. Proprietary and secret software is the moral equivalent of runners in a fist fight." And that's why I think it's not best for consumers. It's really about bun fights between lawyers, and what's best for the consumer really doesn't figure highly in that at all.
Having listened to a few lawyers' takes on this, like competition lawyers, it seems that it isn't a complete slam dunk case, this, because there's no real smoking gun where you can say that raised prices for consumers. Certainly developers have been hit by Apple's tactics. You know, they're paying a tax and they're reliant on Apple to promote their software in the App Store if they want to be successful. You can say it's hurt rival manufacturers potentially, and it's harmed consumers in the sense that it's much harder to switch and leave Apple's ecosystem. And I don't think Apple kind of denies that last point. It would probably say, yeah, if you want a smartwatch that works with the iPhone really well, buy an Apple Watch. Like, it's like Tim Cook's thing, buy a mum an iPhone, right? So it's kind of this ideological point of, can you have a tightly integrated tech ecosystem at the exclusion of others? Is that a valid business choice?
And I think you can, because what you have is open standards, which people adhere to. You can have all companies which are in that ecosystem contributing to the standard, but once it's created, everyone sticks to it. And that way you can compete on a level playing field. And I guess the problem here, as always, when there's bad behavior, is about incentives. Because if you're a small company, you really do have to provide the brilliant service for your customers to grow. Whereas if you're a monopoly, I think you reach the point at which you have such pricing power and the ability to stifle competition that then it becomes much more about maximizing profit and any possible practices you can do to make that happen. That's the problem. I think the utility function suddenly becomes not aligned with your customers. It becomes much more aligned with your shareholders. Because the job of a company, of course, is to maximize profit for the shareholders. That's why it exists.
And Apple has been so good at that.
It has. And it's led to a point where I think they're no longer good for their consumers.
It's interesting, though, because Apple has a lot of customers who really love Apple products and will go out to bat for the company.
But in a way, I think it's almost like a cult where you're convincing people to do things which aren't in their best interests because of their beliefs. Now, I'm not saying it's necessarily the job of the state to avoid these kind of cults where people overpay. Ultimately, it's people's choice. But I don't think it's necessarily best for consumers if they don't have a choice and if they can't buy things because the hugely dominant producer is somehow quashing their ability to choose.
And I guess if Apple loses the coming court case and these things are resolved, it doesn't necessarily degrade the performance of anything in the phone. Like, if they allowed cloud streaming services, who cares if you don't use a cloud streaming service? If they allowed other third-party smartwatches to work as well as the Apple Watch, who cares if you have an Apple Watch? It doesn't stop your Apple Watch working. So it would only lower Apple's profits. It wouldn't necessarily harm consumers. If you want to stay all Apple, all in, I don't think it stops you doing that.
And opening up the App Store to other app stores, I think that would also potentially benefit consumers.
Well, that's what's happening in the EU. The EU is forcing Apple to allow sideloading, as it calls, as in downloading software not through Apple's proprietary App Store, which is a big, big change.
So I think the problem that Apple faces is the hardware business may not grow as quickly as it has in the past. And the big growth has been in the services side. And if they can't continue growing that side of it, then their profitability growth is not going to continue in the future as rapidly as it has in the past. So that's why I think this antitrust stuff really could be a problem for Apple. And if you look at its share price, you can see how much it's suffered since this stuff really started to kick off.
So Apple is in that position of how do you grow from here, really? It's a mature company. And I think it might feel pretty frustrated right now because it can probably say, look, we haven't done the obvious anti-competitive things that other tech companies have done. We haven't gone and bought out competitors. We haven't done what Meta did where they bought Instagram and they bought WhatsApp. Apple doesn't do that. It doesn't make big acquisitions. We haven't monopolized any services. Like obviously Google has a complete monopoly more or less in search. Apple doesn't have that in anything. Like its music store is one amongst many. It hasn't necessarily moved sideways into retail to compete with Amazon or into adverts to compete with Google and Facebook. It's kind of stayed in its lane to a large extent. So I think Apple would argue it's just a victim of its own success.
They did try with the Apple Card, didn't they?
Didn't go so well.
No.
It's interesting that the case in America against Apple is quite different from the action it's been facing in the EU. The EU stuff's all been about, yes, the port that Apple has and forcing it to use open standard USB-C. And then more recently, the App Store forcing it to open that up and responding to complaints from people like Spotify saying Apple is benefiting its own services and forcing us to pay this tax on any sales we make on iPhone. And those all seem like points which benefit the consumer more obviously, I think, than the ones in the US. But some have said that Apple is guilty of malicious compliance in its response to the EU's Digital Markets Act. It's kind of complying in the most obstructive, annoying way possible.
So how would you do that? How would you comply maliciously?
So, for example, it's allowing companies to make sales outside of the Apple platform. However, it's trying to charge a core technology fee, which, as you can expect, makes up most of the lost revenue for Apple. And it said it was going to block web apps, so you couldn't get around it with web applications. It had to row back on that when the EU sort of straight away said, okay, we'll launch another investigation.
And it's not just the EU, is it? For example, South Korea also has some antitrust action against Apple.
And it's not even just Apple. As we said at the start, many big tech companies are facing different cases around anti-competitive practices. Google is currently defending two big cases in the US, one around its monopolization of internet search, especially regarding Android devices, and another one around the ad tech market and how it prioritizes its own services. I mean, the EU has already fined Google more than 8 billion euros in several antitrust cases in recent years. But you could make the argument that all of the big tech firms are running monopolies to some degree. Apple in smartphones, Google in search, Microsoft in operating systems maybe, Amazon maybe in e-commerce, Nvidia in AI chips now, and Meta in social networks. It's not a coincidence that they all run on historically huge profit margins.
Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Are you looking for a new home for your investments? Freetrade has a special offer for you. If you top up or transfer your ISA or SIP with more than £10,000, Freetrade will give you a free share worth between £100 and £2,100. But hurry, this offer ends on 5th of April 2024. Freetrade has taken the stress out of transferring with their purpose-built modern technology. And to keep your mind at ease, customers benefit from FSCS protection. Freetrade won Best Online Trading Platform at the British Bank Awards 5 years in a row. And more than 1.5 million users trust them with their investments. Join today to access over 6,100 US, UK and European stocks, ETFs and investment trusts. So how does the offer work, you may ask? Whether you're an existing customer or looking to transfer your ISA or SIP from a different provider, make sure you open either an ISA or a SIP with an annual standard or plus subscription on or before 5th of April 2024 and keep your account open with a balance above £10,000. You'll be awarded the free share within 90 days. To get started, head over to freetrade.io/transfer or check the link in the episode description below. Capital is at risk. ISA and SIP eligibility, tax rules and terms and conditions apply. Free share value varies depending on the amount topped up or transferred, annual subscription required. Now, another one of the things which monopolies can do, which hurts choice for consumers, I'd say, and also innovation, is if something new comes along, some limited resource, they can completely dominate that resource. And in the case of AI, for example, it's people who know about AI. It's the AI developers and researchers. So really, they have to be very careful when they acquire these companies not to look as if they're just expanding their monopoly. So there was a really interesting case of an acqui-hire by Microsoft recently, or some people might call it a talent raid, where they decided to buy the co-founders and staff of an AI startup called Inflection. So strictly speaking, this was not an acquisition. The company continued to exist after they plundered the staff, and Microsoft continued paying a license to Inflection after the not acquisition. Got to be very careful what I say. And they also hired its co-founder, Mustafa Suleiman, who co-founded DeepMind. So was that an acquisition, or was it not really an acquisition? Or was it an acqui-hire? I'd never heard that phrase before.
It seems to be the accepted startup path to profitability now is that you can have an exit where you sell out to one of the big tech companies. That seems to be just the thing that's done. Very few grow to the size where they list publicly themselves.
But from the point of view of antitrust laws, I don't think that's right, because if you can completely buy up all of the talent and stop other companies from doing so, you can't claim that that's going to be good for innovation. I don't believe it would be.
Yeah, a more active antitrust policy would get involved in acquisitions, mergers, and those kind of quasi-acquisitions much earlier on. Like, I don't think Meta should have been allowed to buy Instagram, and probably not WhatsApp either. They're much bigger acquisitions, obviously, but that's clearly a horizontal move into competitors' space, which shouldn't be allowed. And I know there is actually an ongoing case from the Federal Trade Commission against Meta, sort of retrospectively arguing, oh, we should have blocked them at the time.
We were just asleep on the job.
I mean, if you want to summarise monopoly law, antitrust law, there are several obvious areas which usually are considered taboo. So one is, yes, this thing, the horizontal agreements between competitors which allow price fixing or dividing up a market between them. Obviously bad for consumers if you're caught doing that. The other is the vertical integration, where a firm sort of buys up its entire supply chain and therefore it can stop its suppliers supplying its competitors, and it can maybe control things such as the resale price of its goods in the secondhand market. Those two things, the horizontal and the vertical movement, are what regulators have historically focused on. There are also tactics, like we mentioned, predatory pricing, where you put your prices so low that no one can make a profit, and you do that for a while to kill your competitors, and then you can jack up prices when you're the only one left. You can also limit how your product works with your competitors' products. That's kind of what Apple's been accused of doing on a lot of these points. And you can make conditional sales practices, which can be anti-competitive, such as tying and bundling, it's called, where you try and sell everything together. So you use your market power to force consumers to buy everything you sell. And I guess the final big no-no in antitrust law is when a company uses its dominance in one market to gain an unfair advantage in another.
I think another point, which may not have figured largely in the recent antitrust laws, but which is certainly affecting people's lives, is for the employees. Because if you imagine that you are a mega company, you can really force down wages, and that way you can maximize your profit, of course. And if there aren't other companies you can easily work for in a given space, it's pretty difficult for the employee to command a higher wage.
But I don't know if that point applies to the big tech cases, because, you know, technology workers, software developers are among the highest paid people in society right now. There's not enough of them, I think, to supply all the tech companies that want to be there.
Yeah, certainly for tech, I think you can't argue that developers aren't paid a pretty good wage. They are, relative to other industries. But in other industries, I think it is the case that having that kind of monoculture is not good for the wages which people are paid.
Oh, for sure. I don't disagree with the point. I just think it doesn't necessarily apply to tech. Like, you could argue, you know, Britain having an NHS where there's just one main employer for healthcare professionals has kept their wages low.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I've heard for why UK productivity growth is low.
you know, don't send your letters in. I love the NHS. Don't kill me. I mean, as investors here, we probably all own Apple and Google and all these other companies that are getting prosecuted for running monopolies. How should we expect it to affect returns? You've already said that markets have punished Apple a little bit when these cases were announced with the share price dipping.
Yeah, I mean, overall, it's been very good for investors for a very long time because regulators really haven't thrown back on some of their anti-competitive behaviour. And that means their profits could grow very rapidly. But ultimately, the way the party ends is usually that the government intervenes. And that seems to be what's happening across the world. Now, if a company does get split up, ultimately, this could be good or bad for an investor, depending on which of the child companies, if you like, are the ones that they go for. So, for example, one way to resolve this is to take the parent company and split it up into business units, as happened with AT&T. So AT&T in 84 was split up into seven independent companies. These we call the Regional Bell Operating Companies, or Baby Bells. And depending on which Baby Bell you went for, you could have done pretty well or not very well at all.
Have you seen the actual Baby Bells come in all sorts of colours now? You can get like blue protein Baby Bells, green organic Baby Bells.
You see, my daughter, when we had Baby Bells when she was a little girl, we used to hide them around the house and then fly around the house in her basket, finding all the Baby Bells as if it was a spaceship.
There's too many Baby Bells now, though. Merge them all back into AT&T. I think that kind of did happen, didn't it? Didn't they all get back together eventually?
Yeah, eventually some of them merged back together.
I know that in the big case against Microsoft at the end of the 90s, eventually the ruling was it was going to have to be split off into two companies, one that would have the Windows operating system and one that would own all the software like Office and Word and all of that. It never actually happened in the end, although Microsoft was forced to rein in its anti-competitive practices and give people a choice over browsers and things like that. I think maybe as investors, we've got a bit complacent. Like, we've had this impression that companies can literally keep growing bigger and bigger forever. And that doesn't seem to play out in history, right? Everything always reaches a size and then either breaks up naturally because it's hard to run a big organization at scale, or, like you say, governments step in and split things up. The question, I guess, is that the US market in particular has such high margins at the moment. Some would say because of monopoly pricing power. If companies do start getting split up or are forced to work more nicely with their competitors, will margins fall and therefore will earnings fall and stock prices fall?
So let's consider a tech company like Microsoft. If you did split it up according to that antitrust case in 2003, then what you'd have is two subsidiaries where, you know, one might do slightly better than the other in terms of profit growth. But in terms of margin, I don't think that would change on day one.
I guess what regulators would hope is that consumers have more choice and competitors grow, which potentially drives down prices for consumers of these products and services. Like, they have more choice, therefore competition drives down prices and presume margins.
But I suspect that would be a slow process if there is success in one of these antitrust cases. But what's certainly true is that the market share is going to go down. So the revenue will fall, probably.
Yeah, I don't know if people will stop buying the iPhone in America. I don't know if their market share would necessarily fall. There was an interesting point in the case from the DOJ where their kind of justification is that by having an openness and restricting monopoly practices, what it does is allow the next generation of technology to emerge and be innovated by new companies. So they say, like, IBM was forced to play nicely, which allowed Microsoft to grow. Microsoft was forced to play nicely, which maybe allowed Apple to grow. You know, it had iTunes work with Windows, which allowed the iPod and the iPhone. And then, like, Microsoft allowing other browsers or being forced to allow other browsers allowed Google to come along maybe and dominate search, which allowed other companies like Amazon to build on the internet. Maybe it's a tenuous thing, but this is the kind of case that the DOJ points that maybe it's not about the iPhone and the smartphone market. It's about what comes next and not allowing Apple to dictate that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about this kind of creative destruction and almost enforcing that and allowing it to happen as something which is good and natural in markets. But it happens slowly. So I think if you are a big investor in one of these companies like Apple, I think you're going to have time to switch into an index fund, for example, because if you are an index investor, then you really don't care about who's driving the index higher. It's always a small subset of the companies, which changes from year to year. All that it means is it won't be the same ones as last year.
I mean, I'm an index investor by and large, and I guess I worry slightly in the sense that margins for big tech could fall as a whole. That's possible. If regulators really go after them hard, I kind of get the impression it can leave a shadow over a company. Like Microsoft, for example, really struggled after that big antitrust case because it distracted their whole attention, right? They were so focused on fighting that that they missed out on a lot of growth in the decade or so that followed. And if Apple gets its hands tied and its attention distracted by cases in the EU and the US, is it going to miss out on whatever the next thing is after the iPhone?
But I think this is one of the problems of really large companies. If you've ever worked for one, you've realized that once they become a certain size, the incentive to be innovative, if you're one of their employees, is much lower. Really, you're trying to keep your head down and earn the salary. So I think that's one of the problems, which is once you scale, you're not so hungry, and that's going to slow you down anyway. And I think Apple had kind of reached that stage. They tried to do this as a company, as part of their culture, to instill this startup mentality, not least by hiring lots of startup employees. But ultimately, you work for a big company. You just park your ass on the seat, however many hours a day, and you earn the salary. And if you walk around the headquarters of any big company, you just look around at the people's job titles and you realize a lot of them are kind of bullshit jobs where, you know, it's a level of management where you just think, if I got rid of a third of the people in this room, it would make absolutely no difference to the company.
And everyone thinks that about everyone else in the company. So you're just left with the cleaner, sweeping empty floors. I mean, just to wrap up here, I think overall it's good to see US regulators trying to enforce the law. I find it quite hard to argue that these big tech companies aren't running monopolies. The question is, are they abusing those monopolies? And we'll only really know when they get into court. Because Europe's been pursuing regulation of big tech for a while, I would guess because it doesn't have any of the big tech companies emerging from Europe. So there's less of a downside, right, economically speaking. And obviously China's kept the big tech companies at arm's length. Because up to now, I've often heard it said that America innovates, China replicates, and Europe regulates. I don't know where that came from. I'm going to guess an American. But do you think there's any truth in that? And is America now looking to re-grasp the regulation mantle?
I think on the innovation front, I think more of it will come from outside the US. I think that China probably will start producing its own innovations. You already see that in the EV space. You see it in the 5G space, where America is really starting to lag.
It's leading in AI, though, which is my guess for the next big thing.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that 5G is not important, and I wouldn't say that EVs aren't important. I think there are certain industries where the US has dominated historically, and I think there are others where China will.
So in Europe, are we just left to regulate the Chinese and American imports?
Yeah, well, I think, unfortunately, you know, if you don't create it, you have to regulate it. You know, you end up being further down the food chain.
Because the cynical view is all these fines from the EU against American tech firms are kind of a tax on them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And really, the problem, I think, for Europe is they haven't really got a tech industry like the US has. So really, they've got to find the next thing. I'm sure that something else will come along, but it's just at the moment, they've really missed the boat with AI.
But in summary, as a diversified investor, you don't seem worried if one or two of these big tech companies are taken down a peg or two.
No, I don't mind who's leading the index as long as it's somebody. Now, of course, monopolies are in the news right now, and their impact on stocks is one of the things that many people want to discuss. If you want to join our discussion about things like that, then you can find out more about joining our membership at pensioncraft.com.
Okay, today's dumb question of the week is, what was the Gilded Age? Now, I'm guessing we're bringing this up because it somehow relates to the question of monopolies.
So this was the period between the 1870s and towards the end of the 1800s. And it was a period of lots of industrialization in the US and elsewhere, and lots of rapid economic growth, lots of technological advancement. and a huge increase in the disparity between the rich and the poor. And the actual phrase itself comes from Mark Twain and a novel he co-authored with Charles Dudley Warner in 1873 called The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today. And it talked about all these serious social problems, but masked by a thin layer of gold. So in fact, it's not talking about a golden era. It's just talking about a really tough era for most people with a smattering of gold laid on top.
A golden era for the few, a very, very few. But it was the golden era of monopolies, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There were some people who became hugely wealthy as a result of the turbulence in that period and how well they played it.
And was the playbook typically to build huge trusts? I think that's where the phrase antitrust came from, wasn't it? They would build trusts by buying up all the different regional companies in the same industry. So it might be a banking monopoly you built, or an oil monopoly, or a railroad monopoly, or a steel monopoly. And once you've built it, you have a huge amount of power to set prices and to lobby government.
So just to give an example of one of these centralizing projects, and you've probably heard the name JP Morgan from the bank. He was one of the incredible consolidators at the time, and it was very profitable for him. So there was a merger wave that ran from 1894 to 1904. He set up companies like General Electric, International Harvester. There was a company called American Tobacco, which took 250 companies and merged them into one. And just to look at the extreme concentration of the time, 72 of these consolidations led to a situation where one entity controlled 40% of an entire market. And 42 of the consolidations created situations where one entity controlled upwards of 70% of an industry. So there were just these waves of consolidations, which usually were not good for consumers. They were terrible for workers. And yet at the same time, all the newspapers were cheering on JP Morgan, calling him a heroic commander of the economy.
Were they owned by JP Morgan? Was he like Jeff Bezos with the Washington Post or Elon Musk with Twitter?
I wonder if they listen to this podcast, Michael. Their lawyers might. But even one of the presidents at the time, which is Teddy Roosevelt, who was thought of as the trust buster, because he did bust a few of these trusts initially, turned out to have a gentleman's agreement with companies like JP Morgan's US Steel. But one of the reasons why this was so toxic for people at the time, if you were just a consumer, a normal citizen, for example, in the rail industry, and many of these railway companies really ignored safety provisions on railways and treated their workers badly. And yet the barons of industry were completely unrepentant about this. So here's a quote from one of them. "One human being is killed every hour and one injured every 10 minutes, said W.L. Park, general superintendent of the Union Pacific Railroad. There's a steady grinding and crunching of human flesh and bone under the juggernaut of modern car wheels. It's the price we pay for progress, for the great industrial conquest of the country."
I feel like that's too much. Like, that is what you'd see in some sort of cheesy drama about the Gilded Age. Really on the nose. I mean, no company now would be caught cutting maintenance and letting standards fall. No one would have doors blowing off mid-flight.
Steady, Michael. We should rename this the legal episode.
I said I am not a lawyer. I literally said that in this episode.
Allegedly. You have to say that word a lot.
I mean, I read that if you take some of these Gilded Age barons, for want of a better word, like JP Morgan in banking, John Rockefeller in oil, Andrew Carnegie in steel, you know, look across the New York skyline and you can probably name them from who the buildings are named after.
Yeah.
They were worth, like in today's money, more than $300 billion each. So they towered above even the likes of Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. You know, the wealth they had was incredible and never been matched really in history.
There's a famous quote from George Bernard Shaw when he went to visit the estate of William Randolph Hearst in California. This is one of the newspaper barons, where he just looked at this incredible estate and he said, "This just goes to show you what God could do if he had the money."
Gilded Age seems like an accurate description. Well done, Mark Twain.
But it led to lots of crises. And strangely enough, the rating agencies, because when you have these panics, as happened in 1907, it led to periods of recession, banking crises, and of course, this is going to destabilize the economy. So it wasn't just something which affected a particular sector, it affected everybody.
And it led to the rise of labor unions and antitrust regulation.
So I think that's one of the positives that came out of it, which is to not ignore labor, but to certainly have an eye out for what really can be awful practices and keep industry in check.
It's weird that we had all this regulation in the US around monopolies come out of the Gilded Age and, you know, help end the Gilded Age. And then it kind of got ignored for like 70 years up until recently, really.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there were a spate of antitrust activity around the 1900s and then nothing for a very long time.
Yeah, you had the odd thing like AT&T and Microsoft. It seems to be back in vogue now. We'll see how it plays out. Thank you for joining us for Many Happy Returns. Do send us your questions, no matter how dumb, at the email address mhr@pensioncraft.com.
And do remember to check out pensioncraft.com for all the information about our membership and investment coaching options.
Many Happy Returns is a PensionCraft production, co-hosted and executive produced by Romy Nakiza and Michael Pugh. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes and is not financial advice. We do not provide recommendations or endorse any decision to buy, sell, or hold any security. We cannot be held responsible for any actions listeners may take, and investors are encouraged to seek independent financial advice.